Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
And welcome back to the Second Reading Podcast. I'm Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin. It sounds funny to say it that way now because it used to be it was the University of Texas, period, before they had to balance the interests of everybody. Anyway, happy to be joined today by Josh Blank, Research Director for the Texas Politics, who's here again today. You've already heard from him.
Yeah, I was gonna say, is that what we're doing here, balancing the interests of everybody?
Always, my friend, always. And we're joined by a returning but still very special guest, co-founder, former executive editor of the Texas Tribune, our friend Ross Ramsey. Ross, thank you for coming to campus.
I went to UTEP for a year, and we do appreciate it.
There you go. See?
Yeah, there you go.
Good feelings.
Right.
It wasn't that they were forced to adopt that. But I like the way that they kept the, yeah. Right? It's who we are.
Yeah, we were just a university at...
a University of Texas at El Paso. That's good.
Randos.
A lot going on since last week's pod, and I'm going to take a couple minutes and we'll catch up a little bit and then jump into this. As the legislature is attempting to wrap up their second session, their second special session, the when that's going to happen seems a little up in the air. It looks like, word on the street and just looking at the flow of legislation is they're not going to make that Friday deadline before Labor Day. It's just not what it's looking like. The big must-do item, at least the main must-do item is done. Senate passed a congressional redistricting map over the weekend with a fairly iron-fisted procedural play that undercut plans for a Democratic filibuster at the last moment. If you're listening to this, you probably know about that. I'm sure it'll come up. Move the map out of the Senate amidst just a flurry of bad feelings between partisans and most people involved, I think. Beyond that, House and Senate have been playing that this game of eyeballing each other as they pass legislation back and forth and meet and then adjourn for a few hours and then meet again. I think today the House was meeting early, kind of around regular time to do the usual hearing of bills and receive bills. And then they were going to go on break and then come back this afternoon. And then as of this morning, and then the Senate was scheduled to go in an hour after the House. We've seen tons of that stuff, right, as everything's unfolded. As we record today, two of the most divisive remaining bills are on the House calendar today. So SB 8, limiting transgender access to certain facilities, to use the language of the bill. A Mays-Middleton joint from the Senate is up for consideration on the House calendar today. And then HB 7 seeks to crack down on access to abortion pills by granting, more rights of civil action. That comes up. We can talk about that more. That's also on the floor today. All of which is a very long windup to the discussion we actually want to have and why we're very happy to have Ross here today. I think we have two mixed goals today, to kind of catch up a little bit, bring some of the current events into this, but also to ask the big question, and you're really helpful in this, Ross, is, we're getting there's a lot of feeling going around when you talk to people right now in the process in particular that, things have really changed and that there's a real fundamental kind of changes to the, both the institutions, the practice, we'll get to explicitly the norms of politics and governance in Texas. And I want to look, want to kick around some of the areas where that's happening, see what you guys think in particular. So, we'll start with something we've already queued up. Ross, you think that is the level of hostility that we're seeing new? The level of partisan hostility? There's often people that hated each other.
The level of partisan hostility is new. And the whole thing of you know, you've gone from sort of a culture of let's fight all day and then go have dinner together, or let's go have a drink or something like that.
A drink or 10.
You know, we're colleagues and opponents, and not enemies. And now there's much more of a sense of enemies. And there's a much greater component now of sort of outside pressures on the members, you know, whether it's social media, whether it's activists, whether, you know, whatever it is, you know, I saw you with so-and-so, what's that about? As opposed to,
right,
you know, we sent you to Austin, you did the things you said you were going to do and you came home, you know? So I think there's less of that. That said, you know, the Capitol is built for fights. It's built for conflict, and it's built, you know, so we can either go in this building and argue, or we can go out in the parking lot and fight with swords. Let's go in the building. So there's always something going on, or often something going on, that has everybody sort of intellectually and emotionally involved, and they get hot about it, and they want their way, and they want their way 100%, and they're mad at anybody who denies it to them, and they, you know, they have their moments. But they generally come around. And we've been in a period for several years now, largely because, you know, a lot of these fights are cultural fights. They're not just, we're not just arguing about this business deal or that regulatory deal or something like that.
Right. These are not distributive issues.
Right. And, yeah, you know, it's stuff that, you know, I feel something about. And, you know, and when you get feelings in there, then you get, you know, hurt feelings in there. And, you know, and then the last thing I would add to it is, you know, we were for a very long time in a position in Texas where Texas was, you know, almost contrary to national trends, you know, where you'd see something going on, you know, nationally, and Texas would go the other way, or Texas sort of had its own take on it. And then there was a period where Texas was one of the main laboratories for legislative ideas. You know, California did a lot of stuff that national people looked at and went, oh, that's interesting. And Texas did a lot of stuff that went the same way. Now it's all top down.
Went the same way in a different direction.
Well, it was a different piece of politics, but it was like, you know, conservative policy comes from the Texas and Florida sector, and liberal policy comes from California, to some extent, Illinois, New York. And now we're in much more of a top-down situation, and Texas is following leads, you know, and we've talked about this before on this podcast and in other places, where something happens in national politics and it ripples down into state and local politics pretty quickly. So you start hearing things from school board candidates that you first heard from congressional candidates. It used to be the other way. It used to be more of a bottom-up process. And, you know, the political centrifuge has thrown everybody out to the edges. And so there's not a real overlap in a lot of these things. So, you used to govern on the middle, and you'd say, you know, these guys on the left are a little bit crazy, but they have an interesting idea. And these guys on the right are a little bit crazy and they have an interesting idea. And here in the middle, we're trying to make policy that actually works, and we can take a little from each side and put it together. And now you're sort of in a situation where even conversations between left and right, or Republican and Democrat, are very, very closely watched and, you know, sort of self-regulated. Everybody's like, I don't want to get caught consorting with the enemy, even if the compromise is the policy we want.
I mean, I think in conjunction with sorting of the parties and the polarization you're talking about, you kind of glanced over social media, and this has been a little hobby horse of mine, but I'll take it, which is, you know, the social media piece of that and its echoes or its consequences in mainstream media, your
right,
home for most of your life, has played a huge role in this, I think. You know, I mean,
right,
you know, Brian Harrison, you know, will, for example, to take an example of somebody who's been a gadfly and, you know, a willfully disruptive force, and I don't think he would disagree with that, frankly. You know, we'll take mainstream media hits. I mean, he was on CNN during the quorum break, et cetera. But most of their time is spent just cultivating, for most of their media time, and sometimes just most of their time, is spent cultivating media followings and speaking more or less directly to those kind of, you know, centrifugal edges of the party you're talking about.
Right.
That strike you as right? I mean, you were there as, I, you know, at the Tribune as, the struggle for, are people going to read us or are they just going to go straight to social media because it's more amenable to their frame was happening, right?
Yeah, it's, you know, I started long enough ago that it was, you know, basically mainstream media was newspapers and TV stations and to a great extent radio. And members got, you know, the sort of measure public, instant public sentiment from the size of the mailbags they were getting. They were actually mailbags and you pulled them open and, you know, you read all the stuff. And sometimes it was lobby generated or generated by an association or something.
Yeah.
And so all the letters were the, you know, form letters or whatever. The difference was that if you got sent a mailbag, you could read through those letters, but everybody else wasn't reading through the letters that you got.
Yeah.
So you had all the same trolls and all the same kind of sentiment that you now see on social media, but it was not a public document in the way that social media is. So now, you know, if you get a stream of trolls on any issue, a stream of people jumping up and down one way or the other about an issue, it's not just that you can see it, it's that everybody else can see it.
Right.
And it's pretty easy to look at those things. I mean, we all do this to some extent. The stuff I saw seems to me to be the stuff everybody else is seeing. Whether that's actually true or not is the way you feel about it. And if you're in office and you think, well, you know, everybody I hear from is saying XYZ, you're going to tend to be very mindful of XYZ when you operate. If you do that for a long time, in this case, 25 years, you know, however long you want to call social media, 20 years, it gets embedded that that's what you look at for, that's your thermometer, that's your gauge of what people are thinking, whether it is or not. It's the loudest part, whether or not it's the biggest part.
Well, it's also real-time self-aggrandizing measurement.
Right.
Right. In that, you know, you get an instant like, oh, wow,
That worked.
Yeah. I got 10,000 followers or 10,000 likes. Yeah.
So you learn a new way of talking. And one of the things about the new way of talking is the sharper you are, the better it plays in social media, regardless of the feelings of the person you're talking to. So all the language that you used to use when you were disagreeing with somebody, you know, my esteemed colleague, blah, blah, blah.
Now you can ask if Gene Wu is in China.
The SOB that I'm talking to, you know, the language has changed and all of that. And it's... there's no recognition of your opponent's place in the argument.
Well, and that's a really good transition to the next. I mean, I want to come back to the nationalism and the up down, you know, top down, bottom up thing a little later. But I want to stick with this a little bit because you kind of, if you've been watching the debates, especially in the last week, the language has changed not only in social media. I mean,
it's changed on the floor of the House.
Right. I mean, right. if you happen to watch the debate over the ivermectin bill in the House yesterday, I mean, there was this is not completely new, but there was an amendment that Rafael Anchieta offered that was essentially a trolling amendment,
right.
You know, to rename the bill the Darwin bill because it was...
The Darwin Awards bill, yeah.
Yeah, right. And the language around that, by the time that debate was over, by the time I think Republicans understandably felt insulted, but if you think of the merits of the case, it was clear that that amendment was about saying, hey, this is stupid and suicidal policy.
Right.
But they also, you know, people were saying that exact phrase. But I mean, and she did say that it was something like stupid at the front mic. I mean, and so, you know, it's the reinforcement, but that brings me to the
They've made sure every injury comes with an insult.
Yeah, and vice versa.
Fights that you were going to have anyway were there. You know, you might win this bill, you might lose this bill, you might walk out with sore feelings because you really believed in it. All of that stuff has always been here. That's what the fighting box was built for. But the thing where you take the extra measure of, and when I get you down a little bit, I'm going to kick pretty hard.
Well, that's exactly where I want to go. Josh and I have been like, you know, as you know, we've been working on this intro class that we've been doing. And one of the concepts that we introduced kind of at the front end of the class was norms.
Yeah.
Right? Talking about changing norms.
Right.
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 And, you know, we've seen a lot of that.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, no, that's exactly what I mean. You sort of go back over the session and there have been a couple of different instances where people have kind of raised their head up and said, wait a minute, this is pretty weird. You know, and so you start to think about, you know, earlier in the session, we saw Patrick attempts sort of late at night to refuse to reduce to writing some of the comments that had taken place, which was pretty unusual. And it sort of had a pretty big, I'd say, maybe one of the, honestly, recently, probably the biggest pushback from the Senate that, I mean, I can think of.
Yeah, because he got some.
Yeah.
Well, but that's an institutional infraction, right? It's right. Like, you know, wait a minute, you're not, you know, you've always called these balls and strikes, and now you're calling them, you know.
Well, I mean, yeah, that's tricky.
Well, right.
You know, and then, you know, obviously there's the whole sort of financial and legal, if civil penalties on legislators by other legislators. There's the efforts by the executive branch to remove legislative branch members, which sort of just in a basic sense is kind of crazy. There's the denial of the filibuster that we talked about, you know, right in a few days. And then there's this all sort of general open hostility, the reality of, you know, future Democrat committee chairs and all this stuff. And it is like, you kind of look back over the session is like, is this when the dam breaks? I mean, part of, and I'll just throw one other question out there since I'm going to keep my comments limited here. I mean, one of the things I'm thinking about as you guys are talking about this is I know that, like, this is obviously part of a long trajectory. I mean, you know, when you talk about the idea, like, you can't even go on a – can't even go to dinner with somebody because we were in a seat. I'm thinking about, you know, O'Rourke and Heard going on that trip and putting on social media and people just being pissed about it, especially Heard even doing it. Like, that's how long back this has been going, this idea of, like, oh, this is a terrible idea, two guys sitting together and talking. So this has been ongoing, but there is part of me that also wonders just to 2 year points and you can bring it back – but one, you know, how much of this do we have to caveat by the fact that we are in the second special session? Nobody wanted to be here as far as we can tell if we were asking this question in April. You know, like nobody expected it necessarily or wanted that.
That's kind of a given for special sessions,
it's
right?
Well, that's the thing. So that's already churning the temperature up. And then the other piece of it that I was thinking about, you're talking about the top-down nature of it. And I mean, one of the things that strikes me as tricky here, and I think one of the things that makes this challenging for Texas is like, you know, when somebody says, hey, there's this problem, there's this scourge that liberalism is inflicting on America. Well, you know, this is still Texas, right? And so it's kind of like when you say like, well, you know, the liberals are doing A, B, and C, you know, you kind of in Texas, where are they doing that? You know, you're kind of looking around because like, well, you know, in some sense, I mean, in a different instance we can point to, it's sort of like we end up with policies in search of problems.
Sure.
Increasingly. And I wonder how much that in and of itself also just filters into this in the sense that this isn't a bottom up, but we have this problem here, we need to deal with it. So therefore, and then that leads to hurt feelings. This is like, everybody's going to deal with this, whether it's a problem or not. And now you're fighting this fight that honestly, like, I think a lot of people, at least, you know, Democrats are looking at, well, wait a minute, when was this a problem? So I mean, just sort of like, I'm trying to like caveat this a little bit in some ways and understanding how much of this is sort of short-term pressures and how much of this is long-term trajectory that doesn't change, speaking of norms, right? Like, is the horse out of the barn? Is it just like, there are no more Democratic committee chairs? Is like next session going to be awful or is it going to revert back in some way?
It's, you know, the goals have changed a little bit. You know,
yeah.
There are places where you say, we're here to get a new policy in place.
Mm-hmm.
Kerrville had these floods. And we need to do some things to make sure that this doesn't happen this way again. We're going to have more floods, but, you know, let's prepare for it. Let's, you know, we're actually dealing with policy. There's something
right.
That we need to address. We all know we need to address it. It doesn't matter what party you're in. A flood's a flood. And we've got to take care of this.
Right.
Or a few years ago, the freezes. Mm-hmm. You know, we have to do something with the grid. We have to, you know, all of these kinds of things. You still have those things where you come in and your job is to do policy and
right.
To do things. And the goal is clear to everybody, and those tend to be the places where they work together. You know, Congress comes together every once in a while because we've got an external threat. We've got, you know, war or something, and all of a sudden, oh, wow, that acts like Congress. Who knew they could do that? When they're not doing that, they're doing other things, and they have other goals. And one of the goals that the parties both have at this point is to embarrass the other party and to shame the other party and to put them in a position where they look like a bunch of idiots. And so I'm going to, the fact that I've introduced a piece of legislation, whether or not it passes,
yeah.
Put an asterisk there, I'll come back. Whether or not it passes, the argument favors me and shames my opponent. I could make that point about the, you know, the various bills about trans people. You know, if you're going to do a bathroom bill, and you're going to win or lose, and you really want this argument to proceed because it benefits your side and hurts the other side, losing the argument isn't such a bad thing because it prolongs the argument. And if
yeah.
I prolong the argument, I'm going to prolong the pain to my opponent, and I'm going to prolong the benefit to my guy. So you get all these cultural issues kind of wound up in this. And you have, you know, I think you have to look at a lot of things that are introduced in the legislature, not just now, but, you know, they seem to be more acceptable institutionally right now to introduce things that put my opponent in a bad position and really don't have beans to do with real public problems or real public policy.
But it's that acceptability that I wanted to ask you about, right? I mean, that's really the heart of the question is, you know, you could probably come up with examples of that, you know, communication slash agenda management strategy in the past, right?
Sure.
I mean, but I guess, you know.
Sure, this was what all the, you know, we went 20 years on tort reform.
Right.
And you know, one of the underlying arguments in tort reform was the people who were being sued were the people who financed one party, and the people who were suing were the people who financed the other party. You know, and that was a long discussion. You know, the trial lawyers were with the Democrats and the business people are with the Republicans. It wasn't a clean, you know, 100% either way, but it was enough of one where you were sort of watching this thing that looked like a business fight was also a political proxy fight.
Yeah.
Right. Now you have things that really don't have that veneer of policy in front of them, right? They've just got, you know, this is just a fight. We're going to have this fight. You know, if I want to start, and, you know, one that's been around for 100 years, you know, or more, you want to have another book ban fight? We can do that. And, you know, we, you know, both of us in our way will benefit from this argument in a way that has nothing to do with public policy. The public policy and the legislative rooms that we're in are really just the forum for a culture fight that benefits us with our bases.
I wonder, I mean, if that is also, I mean, I've been wondering if that part of that, though, is also, you know, the function of the fact that because of Trump's ascendance of the office, you know, what we've seen, at least in polling, is, you know, Republicans are less concerned about the border and they're less focused on immigration, thinking, you know, basically with the assessment that Trump is doing a better job of handling that issue. And one of the things that does is it takes what has been the perennial number one issue among Republicans that you can hang all kinds of issues to, right, around education, around healthcare, around provision of social services. And you could put that on immigration and sort of really just make a nice package that speaks to most of your voters. And then once you pull that away, you know, you are searching for other things, right? You're searching for these other avenues to go and find and motivate people into it. But also it's kind of like it gets a little crazy. I mean, just to say, I mean, like one of the things I was thinking, you know, having watched this for a little while now, I mean, it used to be you'd say, well, you know, there's only so many hot button issues they can really hit and get their business done.
I would change the emphasis. There are so many.
Well, now, let's say now you're issues. Like, now there are so many. Yeah. Hot, and that's the thing. Right. But it used to be, you would say, like, you know, at least like 10 years ago, like, well, you know, they don't want to deal like all these things, but they're gonna have fights over a couple of them.
There've always been a couple.
Yeah.
There've always been.
But now it feels like there is no limit.
Well, you know, and it's sort of the dominant, you know, go back to what Jim was saying about social media. What makes this engine run?
Yeah.
Is argument and conflict, and if it's got a little prurient edge to it, that's great. And you know, right. if we can get this thing into an argument where we've turned the politics from a mix of sort of a logical approach to problems along with the emotional reaction to those problems, if we can turn this into a strictly emotional thing and make it an emotional argument, which cultural issues tend to do, you know, I can just make it a food fight, and you know, food fights work great on social media. And politicians respond to what, you know, to perceived public opinion. And now we're back to everybody's reading the same mailbag and they're looking at it and going, you know, well, we probably should have a fight about book bans, or we should probably have a fight about trans athletes because everybody, quote unquote, is talking about it.
Yeah, I think that was a really good point that you're making. I never thought about that notion of, you know, it's one thing to get, you know, however many mailbags you get on this issue that you may or may not have addressed. It's another thing for everybody to look at your mail and see the receipts. And it does sort of speak to, you know, we've been talking about like the extent to which, you know, at least in my perspective, you know, part of what Abbott is able to do by setting the special session agenda is to inoculate himself from any sort of criticism that he hasn't dealt with a given issue. Whether or not the legislature deals with it, he can't. You know, that's not necessarily his problem because, hey, I put on the special session. They either, you know, they did or they didn't. But part of that is, you know, it makes a lot more sense to think, you know, why are we talking about ivermectin? It's like, well, you know, because if enough people got on that, got out there and sort of made a point of it, that's basically now enough to say, you know, let's make sure we address this for the people.
Right. And wind it back. You know, if you have watched this a little bit and you're in this business, you begin to understand how to kind of stampede the horses. And how do I get ivermectin even into the argument? Well, and now we're back to top-down national politics.
It's I start this conversation,
and if I can get it going, then the argument is going to benefit us, and I started the issue in the first place, so I don't have to argue about all the other issues that I didn't start that they started.
Well, to go back to my original question, and, you know, Josh sort of, you know, offered his answer to
yeah,
it,
sorry.
But I think that I guess the question I have is, are all the things you guys are suggesting are part of this? Mm-hmm. Some short-term, intermediate things, polarization, signaling from the top, individual incentives, you know, this. But it, I guess my question is that the it used to be, I think, that there was some internal regulatory mechanisms, part of which were historical practice and norm-based, maybe, to my mind, where the strategy was for the leadership to throttle that stuff, right? In other words, you and I have talked a lot where, you know, okay, so what we're going to do, you know, it's time to send all the abortion bills to state affairs, have a couple of hairy hearings, and then we're not going to hear about them anymore.
Right.
Right. I mean, and I don't want to overgeneralize that, but that was kind of a Laney approach that even kind of bled into the early Craddock days, I think, and could even arguably be said to characterize kind of the Strauss approach in the House.
There's always an issue. I mean, even now, there's an issue where the management, whoever is in charge, says, we're going to do that later. So let's give it enough of a pass that everybody can say we didn't ignore it, but we're not going to pass that this time.
Right. And so my question about that is then, you know, and I don't know if this is cause or effect in terms of this norms discussion, is that balance seems to have shifted.
Yeah.
Right. I think, you know, there's a lot more, you know what, we're just going to, you know, at least in the House, you know what, this is just going to come to the floor.
Right.
And in some ways, the thing that used to often strike me as just a line has actually become a little more true in that, you know what, we're going to bring it to the floor and the body's going to decide.
Right.
Now, I don't want to seem like a rube. I know that's not necessarily what, but it does seem to me like the shift in that balance between the share of the kind of issues we gotta do, or we all agree on, or we recognize, you know, as a policy matter we're going to get, and the other stuff that you guys are kind of raising in terms of the political benefits of whether it's ivermectin or abortion or trans bill, whatever,
right?
That all of that seems to have shifted, and it does seem like the expectations around that are shifting, right? That you've got a core of people in both bodies, you know, right now largely in the majority party, but there's probably a Democratic correlate to this in the minority, if I could think about it, that aren't willing to accept the earlier practices and the norms around them, saying, hey, look, this is a body, you're in a party where some members, this is a very hard vote for. And so you're not always going to get those bills. I mean, that was kind of the underlying reasoning. And it just seems to me that maybe I'm making the norms thing more complicated. Maybe it's just polarization and more homogenous parties and the accretion of one party being in charge for a long time.
Right.
But I still think that if you take those as the primary explanations, you've created a reinforcing dynamic in which you've got, you know, an increasing number of members whose institutional memory is not of this previous balance between policy and ideology or policy and social issues. Mm-hmm. It's more just what's happened the last few years, and there has been a lot of turnover.
You've got a change in goals too. So, you know, at one time the norm was, if I'm a presiding officer, if I'm the lieutenant governor or the speaker, part of my job is to protect the people in the House or the Senate, protect the body, right?
Right.
So I'm going to do this in a way that abortion was a great example. When Bill Hobby was the lieutenant governor and Billy Clayton and Gib Lewis were the speakers in succession, most of the Republicans, who were a very small minority at the beginning of that era, most of the Republicans didn't want to vote on abortion either. And so, you know, they were mostly, you know, moderate Republicans or liberal Republicans, whatever you want to call them. And the Democrats didn't want to vote on it. So the idea was, okay, look, there is a loud group of voters who want this to be on the agenda. And we're going to acknowledge this as an item that's on the agenda. But we're also, because nobody wants to vote on it.
But you can't make me.
Well, none of the members really wanted to vote on it. And they didn't want to, you know, the vote was going to be divisive, which is fine if you really, really believe in the thing. But also, it's going to mark everybody. And once you're marked, then we're going to have this political races, and our political races are just going to be about this one issue, which would be great if we thought it was the main issue, right? And so we're just going to park that. And we're going to spend our time doing whatever else we're doing. We're going to do tort reform, or we're going to do brucellosis, was a, you know, special session item at one time. Whatever the heck it is. And the idea is that the members are protected. They'll keep voting for the speaker. They'll keep responding to the lieutenant governor. Every once in a while, you get something divisive. So we had the famous killer bees thing when Bill Hobby wanted to get a bill that was about, you know, about election law. The Democrats didn't like it. Enough of them decamped to stop consideration of it. And finally, Hobby came around.
And for the youngins out there, as a reminder, Bill Hobby was a Democrat.
Yeah, Bill Hobby was a Democrat. And, you know, so they did a quorum bust. I mean, you know, they've done quorum busts all the way through history. They did them in Congress. Abraham Lincoln went out the window of Congress one time to deny them a quorum. You know, this has been around for a while. It wasn't a regular tool. It's become kind of a regular tool. Yeah. But all of these things were in place. And, you know, you had all of these things where every once in a while somebody would do something extraordinary, and there was always a little bit of an institutional bruise after it was done. And everybody would say, you know, that was, you know, I understand why you did that and it worked, but, you know, let's don't make that a regular thing because that's kind of an awful way to do business, right? As you get into a political era where those kinds of issues that are very appealing to a loud minority in one party or the other convinces the people at the top of that party that they have to respond. And maybe those people are speakers and maybe those people are lieutenant governors. Then they put them on the agenda and they put them up for full consideration. And the shift changes from, I'm going to protect the members so that this is an operating body and we have comity and all of that kind of stuff, into a place where this is a place that reflects the, you know, sometimes nasty politics of what's going on outside. And so the argument that happens out in the idea marketplace, which right now some people regard social media as, is going to play out inside the legislative halls, and it's going to be just as nasty as it is online.
Well, and I think, you know, you have to, that's where you have to put more homogenous parties in, right? Even in a couple of your examples, you know, where you're saying, you know, we're not going to push abortion bills because, you know, a lot of the Republicans actually don't, you know.
Right.
But a lot of those Republicans have been replaced. I mean,
right.
That's part
well,
of
it. Well, exactly.
I mean,
well, but that was at the time, right? No, that's what I'm saying.
No, this is how we got to here.
This is when the party's Venn diagram overlapped,
you know,
significantly. And
which
now
they don't.
It does a little, but.
On some issues, but not on a lot. You know, the point is, I think, in a lot of ways, on the social issues, is to find those issues where they don't.
Right. Right. Because, and that goes back to what I was saying, you know, the fight is more important than the result. You know, the fact that we're fighting. And then you get into things that are, you know, straight up politics that have always been this way, like redistricting.
Well, that's where I wanted to go next. That's perfect because, you know, in some ways, this redistricting fight looks very familiar, but in other ways not, right? I think.
Redistricting is always, I'm going to eat as much cake as I can, you know, and you're going to try to stop me and eat as much cake as you can. And that's kind of how this goes. And we used to have stronger legal constraints and court-ordered restraints on how much cake you could take and how you could take cake.
Right.
Keep this weird analogy going on.
Please.
I like cake.
So, you know, there was a strong correlation in places like Texas between the voting patterns of blacks and Hispanics. They had a high correlation to Democrats and Republicans. You know, blacks were 80 or 90% Democratic votes, and Hispanics were 60 to 70%, you know, depending on where you were, Democratic votes. And so if you were drawing a map and you were constrained by civil rights laws, you could hide your partisan workings under the guise of civil rights. You know, we're drawing these districts so that these voters or these voters or these voters have a right to express their opinions and have a reasonable chance of getting somebody who represents their views into Congress or the legislature or the county commissioner's court or whatever the heck it is. And as those civil rights protections have being peeled away by the Supreme Court largely, and the Supreme Court's decision that partisan fights in redistricting cannot be adjudicated, justiciable, I think is the word they use, it became okay to just say, no, actually, you know, this isn't based on race or anything at all. This is just based on we Republicans or we Democrats getting as much votes as we can.
It's like, oh, there's more cake.
There's more cake. So California has 47 seats in Congress, and 7 of them are Republican. And Texas has 38 seats in Congress, and 13 are Democratic. And that's disproportionate to the votes statewide in either state. So in Texas, you know, Democrats generally get 40 to 43% of the vote. And in the maps that just got approved and that Abbott's, you know, about to sign, they would have 21% of the seats in the congressional delegation. It's not representative, but it's legal.
Right.
Yeah. Well, and it'll be more comparable to what it looks like in some of the other states that are gerrymandered in either direction.
Right, which is kind of the Republican defense.
And you know, what generally happens, I mean, you know, sort of the textbook argument here is, wait a minute, this doesn't represent the people who are the voters. You're not taking care of the voters. You're taking care of the parties, and you're doing it on behalf of the politicians who happen to be incumbents right now and who regard their incumbencies as properties of their parties that should be passed from one member to another. So when this one ages out, I get another person from the same party. That's not exactly what anybody had in mind at the beginning, but we've left all of that behind. Redistricting is always about taking as much as you can get. And as these constraints have fallen away, the parties have been able to get more and more.
You know, what's interesting about it is you put it that way, when you phrase it that way, you know, one of the recent exceptions that I think was, you know, fairly widely noticed was that the 2021 redistricting here was not as take as much as you can get as it usually is.
Yeah. Right.
You know, on a partisan basis. Right. And, you know, in some ways that's maybe, I mean, there are a lot of more proximate causes, but it's also one of the reasons it hasn't held politically.
But it's also disproportionate to the statewide vote.
Yeah. Well,
the congressional districting is more Republican than the state electorate.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. Legislative's pretty even. Well, and, you know, it's a little bit more, but it's not, you know, it's not like an outlier.
Well, and interesting to the point, you know, you're making, and I think it's also regardless of the legal landscape, just thinking about the future political landscape, you know, it's making the congressional, the distribution of the racial demographics of the state increasingly disproportionate in the congressional districts, right? So, I mean, if most of the population growth in the state over the last 2 decades was driven by non-white population, by no, something like 90%+. The last round of redistricting increased the share of congressional districts that were majority white. This next round of redistricting, or this current round of redistricting, is going to increase that further. And there is sort of a, you know, again, this is sort of, we're kind of in this moment where, you know, what race and ethnicity means in the context of politics, the law, everything else is very much, you know, a kind of on the tip of things. But it is interesting to think, just from a representational standpoint, if race is a big part of this or not, that like the state is becoming less representative in that, even if it is becoming more or less, I guess, representative.
An interesting thing that occurred to me as you were in your phrasing of how you recounted, you know, kind of the height of the civil rights, you know, influence on redistricting, is this idea that, and I'm going to put words in your mouth a little bit, so feel free.
I'll fight back. Go ahead.
But I think it's just, you know, I mean, it seems like, you know, you were kind of playing like, look, when the Democrats drew maps, they drew them to their advantage, you know, with the very available and reasonably legitimate cover of saying, you know, this is because we are the party of ensuring representation. I'm using this out of historical context, to people of color, to our constituents of color.
Right.
And that was kind of, and almost in a sense, the implication was, you know, race became kind of the mask for partisanship.
Right.
In a very explicit way.
Right.
And when you listen to the recent discussions and the way that that has now been inverted rhetorically by Republicans, it's a very interesting contrast, yes, which is, no, we're not thinking about race at all.
Right.
And we're going to go to absurd heights to go, yeah, I don't even know that there were people of different colors in those districts when we drew those maps.
Sort of the John Roberts idea of, we're past that. We're post, you know.
Exactly. Even though, you know, I mean, look, that's.
But both sides, but now go back to.
It's an interesting historical inversion, right? Or refiguration of how we talk about race that I think is indicative of things you and I have been talking about and that are clearly out there in which the rhetoric of how we've talked about race is very, we're in like the post-civil rights movement era.
Or right? In a re-civil rights movement. I mean, this is also, you know, to go back to what we were talking about with cultural fights, this is an argument both parties kind of want to have.
Do you think?
I do. I think that the idea of, you know, what the country is becoming demographically, the Democrats and Republicans either want to consider it and use it, depending on their situation, to their own political advantage. And I think a lot of politics, I mean, obviously redistricting is all about politics. I think that to the extent that this underlies it, they want to have the cultural fight about it.
Republicans, to your skepticism about whether they want to have it or not, I mean, I think one of the advantages the Republicans have right now in this fight is that they're pretty unified. They realize pretty clearly, both legally and culturally, where the cultural moment is good for them to make the kind of argument that they're making, which is explicitly, we're not talking about race at all, but implicitly, well, you know, but the Democrats have the problem in that some Democrats really want to have this fight, but others are kind of saying, you know, we've been losing these fights. How do we keep our commitments, but inch away from, you know, I shouldn't even say inch away, but, you know, turn it down from, you know, 10 to 6 or 7. In some ways, you know, at least a faction of the party is, you know, all the talk about like, well, we're listening to the groups too much.
Well, I would say it's not even about turning it down. It's about reconfiguring it. And the thing that the Democrats haven't figured out how to do is reconfigure, you know, a lot of language and politics around groups and around race that was formed both around, you know, African Americans in particular, and legal fights and legal rights that were extended to African Americans in particular based on their unique experience in this country. But now you're looking at a population, especially in Texas, that's shifting so much demographically. You know, the fastest growing, you know, demographic group in the country is mixed race. When you're talking to Hispanic people who, you know, first of all, pan-ethnic identifier who come from many different countries, many different generations in the U.S., living in different parts of the country with different political profiles, just taking sort of the rhetoric that was used to sort of talk about group consciousness in African Americans is clearly not working right now, or at the very least, it's created an opening. And Republicans have walked right into it and are very happy to say, hey, we don't see color. This is the new America. You know, we're just looking for, you know, who best and the brightest right now. Anybody who's read this history, whatever, knows sort of the nature of colorblind and how that sort of stuff is used. But the thing is you sort of look at the last 5 or 6 years or more, you say you had Black Lives Matter, you had sort of a DEI push, and we're very much in a backlash to that right now. And that's where the emphasis and the momentum is. And while Republicans are, I think, very comfortable walking forward into that, and they've been shown they are, I don't think Democrats know what the hell they're doing with themselves right now.
Right now, the Republicans have the Democrats split on the issue.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
So that's why I'm a little bit, I don't know if they both want to have that fight. I mean, I think Democrats are hopeful.
Well, I guess, that I guess I should say the Republicans want to have the fight and some of the Democrats do.
Yeah, and I think the Democrats are hopeful in the abstract that there's a backlash to the backlash. That at some point, you know, there is a sort of like, nobody asked for this and you're going like above and beyond what anybody said. And so now, you know, but the other side of it is I don't think Democrats know how to talk about this. And we talk about this all the time. But like, you know, if you say like, well, look, let's talk about racial and ethnic minorities in Texas. It's like, well, who are we talking about?
Right.
You know, it's kind of like, and not to say that like historically that doesn't have real concrete meaning, 100% it does, but in the politics of the moment, that meaning may not apply to most people who are just, you know, coming to these issues.
Well, and not to sound, you know, like somebody out of time, I guess, but, you know, what's lurking underneath that partially is that, well, you know, we use the term backlash all the time in a number, and I think I'm not saying it's not the right, but I mean, I think there's something when we talk about backlash that sometimes has this connotation that it's a little bit ephemeral, like we're just going to wait for the backlash to pass and then things will swing back. And I think the key thing to remember about this is that, you know, the backlash to civil rights is really tapping into something that never went away.
Right.
Since Reconstruction.
Right.
Right. In other words, this resistance to this, to, you know, whatever term you want to use, the idea of a multiracial democracy, civil rights enforcement, plural, you know, whatever there has been resistance to that from the from moment the Civil War ended.
Yeah, right.
Right. And it never really went away.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things that is, you know, interesting to use a too academic and too neutral term about watching this unfold, you know, is the degree to which, you know, the basic precepts never really kind of went away.
This is never over.
Right. And
so far anyway.
And so this is really a reassertion and a kind of, you know, that's why I was kind of, you know, struggling with a kind of post-civil rights era terminology, something like that. But we're definitely in a resurgence of something that's always been brewing and, you know, fueled the chipping away of civil rights stuff, you know, civil rights achievements or civil rights legislation and civil rights jurisprudence, you know, almost from the moment it existed.
Yeah.
Right. And right. So I want to, you know, so we don't go on for too much longer. One more thing before we go back and tie this together, I think, with the thing that ties a lot of it together, which is the nationalization discussion. But something I'm interested in talking to you about, Ross, and we talked about this intermittently, and that's the, you know, the argument that one factor, and it's actually even raised its head a little bit in this discussion we've already had, is the increase in the gravity of the executive branch, and in particular the governor's office in the state political system over at least, the, you know, certainly the last couple of governorships.
Right.
And, but certainly, you know, I think in a very, very conscious way with Greg Abbott. Is that, I mean, does that read make sense to you? Do you think it's permanent? I mean, I, you know, I always say when we went back, you know, and we probably talked about this at the time, when Perry handed off the governorship to Abbott, one of the big discussions was, well, you know, Perry's kind of built this thing up. Is Abbott going to be able to maintain it or not? And right. I think we have a pretty, to my mind, yeah. we have a pretty clear answer to that now.
Well, I think you're right to pin it on both of them. You know, Perry started this thing early on where he began the process of, I'm not only appointing people to run these executive agencies, I'm appointing people who will report back. And over time, because he was in office for 14 years, he was able to not only increase his influence and communication with those boards, but also with their top executives. So after Perry had been in office, you know, somewhere toward the end of his, you know, first 8 years or so,
yeah,
you could see that almost all of the executive agencies, the executive director, probably the general counsel, certainly the communications office, were all former Perry employees. They'd actually worked in the governor's office.
Yeah.
You know, and they were, you know, and this network went out and they were very methodical about this. And they had looked at, you know, some predecessors. You know, Bob Bullock, when he was controller for 16 years, had placed people all over state government because it was an office that spun off a lot of experts. And, you know, my agency needs a budget expert. Well, where do I go for that? I go to the controller's office. So one of Bullock's people is in my shop now. And, you know, and, you know, people who really study government, who are in the practice of it, were looking at this and going, this is very, very clever. And two of them were Rick Perry and Rick Williamson, who worked with Rick Perry a lot. Yeah. They'd been House members together. And so they began to do this to the governor's office. And so they had this, they spread their tentacles. And, you know, it went to boards of regents at universities. It went to the boards that oversee big departments like highways and health and parks and wildlife and all of those kinds of things. So they kind of set that groundwork in place. And this is what Greg Abbott inherited. He was attorney general during this whole time, watching this and from time to time blessing it and certainly defending right. it wherever it got, you know, challenged. So he was familiar with the thing and familiar with the argument and, you know, the idea of Texas constitutionally has a weak governor and the party that's in control now has some tendencies toward liking unitary executives. You know, the person in charge is the person in charge. So what else could you do? Well, what if the agencies had to go through the governor's office to get their administrative rules approved? Whenever you pass a big piece of legislation, particularly something like a tax bill, you got to write a bunch of administrative law to say, okay, here's how we're going to administer this tax. And all these minor arguments about, you know, the bill says this, that means you could tax X or right. not tax X. What
There's are
you
a rulemaking process.
It's all rules. Yeah. And, you know, it's very, very, it's where a lot of the power in the executive branch is. you know, taxes, environmental controls, all of that stuff, all the regulations. So what if all of that had to go through the governor's office? Well, voila, now it does. What if, you know, they all reported back and it became more of a thing where the governor actually is the CEO and not just somebody who has all of these fiefdoms. Yeah. I name these people and then they go off and do whatever they do. We're not going to do that anymore. You know, I'm going to get blamed when the state freezes over and the power goes off. So
yeah.
I'm going to have some direct control, damn it, over the Public Utility Commission and ERCOT, right? I mean, you get those kinds of things. Greg Abbott's consolidated that power to a terrific extent. One of the things we're watching in Washington is Trump doing, you know, with a strong office, something like the same thing to make it, try to make it even stronger. And some of the, you know, one of the things that I think is fascinating about this that they're doing that's similar is, you know, there's sort of a body of folklore that says you can't do that. You're a weak governor or the president can't do that. Right. And, you know, Abbott quietly and Trump loudly have come in and said, what if I do? What are you going to do about
it? You know what that sounds like to me? A change in norms.
Well, that's a change. Well, yeah, but it's a thing where you say, you know, I'm going to do this, and if they stop me, okay, but I'm going to try it. I'm going to push the envelope. I'm going to push. You know, I'm going to test all the fences, and it turns out that a lot of those fences are pretty weak, and you can go through them, and nobody says anything, and by the time they do say something, you say, well, I've been doing this for years. You know, I've been at it for a long time.
Or you've moved on to some other area.
Moved on to something else. Or, you know, this is politics and everybody's a temp, right? I mean, we don't live forever. And you get the thing where you say, well, it worked while I had it. And, you know, during the 10 years I was in office or the 14 years or however long these guys are in office, it worked while I had it is all really that you wanted, you know, because that's how I wanted to work it. And if they change it later, you know, they change it later. That's the next guy's problem.
So it seems like, you know, what we're talking about here is some level is a story of, you know, individual political entrepreneurs stretching both institutional rules and norms and then it feeding back onto the institutions theoretically, right? So that's my question is, or the next question, obvious one is, so Abbott eventually leaves office.
Right.
Presumably. And
death is undefeated.
And he, oh, are you watching Alien Earth, my friend?
Not yet, but I will.
Does it last? Right. I mean, in other words, I mean, because my feeling is
does
kind
it persist,
of it's almost like it. You know, it's the opposite of coastal. I mean, it depends on what you want to, what the object is, but it just seems like, you know, there are fluctuations, but this is where the pendulum is kind of misleading to me. It feels to me more like, you know,
it's like
you
a make,
you know, you, you step forward and then maybe the next person isn't quite as strategic, able to take advantage. The legislature develops more of a spine and pushes back. You get divided, you know, whatever, right? Yeah. Whatever the thing is, but you, you know, it feels to me like Abbott and Perry have done enough that I don't expect too much receding beyond the variable of how good are you at, you know, occupying the office.
And the real way that it would recede, whether at the national level or here, would be if the legislature says, hey, wait a minute, we don't like this. I mean, part of this is a reflection of all the stuff that we've been talking about, right? Yeah. I mean, you know, when you look at sort of the willingness of either Trump or Abbott to sort of take the space that's given to them and you say, well, where was that space given? A lot of the times it was given by the legislatures because they were, because they say, hey, you make the rules.
There's a lot of stuff in the state budget that Abbott has decided to interpret in a particular way that used to be completely legislatively control of the executive branch. You know, they would write a rider into the budget and say, thou shalt not. And Abbott's taken the position that, you know, I can veto riders and, you know, all of those kinds of things. And, you know, it's a question of what can I get away with? How much can I do without the judiciary, one of the other branches of government stepping in and saying, stop there.
Yeah.
And then, you know, everybody is going to be in a position, every governor is going to be in a position where he or she is going to be doing things and somebody's going to say, you can't do that. And they're going to go, wait a minute, why not? Right? And how do we get around that? And they're going to pull in their lawyers and everything and say, how do we get around that? I want to get done what I want to get done. And, you know, to your ocean analogy, you know, this is erosion. And, you know, when you basically Abbott is establishing a new fence line. And yeah. it may be that the next governor or the governor after that doesn't go all the way to that fence line, but goes way past where the fence line was when Perry yeah. was governor, or when Bush was governor, or when Richards was governor. Yeah. It's, you know, we've got a stronger governor state in place today than we did 20 or 30 years ago.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people would probably look at that, you know, in both parties and say, you know, it is an executive position and this is the executive part of the state. And we did elect them to run the thing and we're going to blame them for everything that goes wrong. So what's the problem? And then the question is, okay, what would be the legislature's basis for taking it back? And I think the only way the legislature takes any of this back or the courts take any of this back is if a governor goes so far that they go, that's not going to be allowed. But I don't think that they get all the little things in the process. I think they'll slap down and say, you can't do that. It's like, okay, that's a solid fence now.
Well, that's a great transition to the final, you know, just the return to the national influences thing. Because as of now, the national example we're looking at suggests that counting on the other branches to say, hey, that's too far. Our expectations, I think, have been kind of frustrated. You know, a lot of people's expectations anyway. I'll just say my expectations have been kind of frustrated by that, in which we've seen the executive in this presidential term in particular push those boundaries and people kind of go, yeah.
I mean, it's clear that in the Congress, the calculus is not in political interest to try to push back on any of that
right.
so long as it's not. Right. I mean, the question is, is it possible for that calculus to ever flip? And I think it's unlikely that calculus is going to flip anytime soon in this current configuration. I keep going back to this point because I think it is kind of worth remembering just about and I know that it goes beyond this, but one of the things that I recall about, you know, Roberts being made the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court when he was nominated, and one of the big benefits to the Bush administration in nominating him at that point in time was the fact that he was known for having such an expansive view of executive power.
Yeah.
That he had a history of having this, you know, sort of expansive view of executive power. Post 9/11, this was seen as a great asset. And ultimately, you know, in some ways, I guess I'm, you know, comforted by the consistency of it. You know, in some ways, you're looking at it like, yeah, that's what they said. You know,
they said it right there on the contents of the box. Right?
Yeah, they said it when they put him up there. And I mean, who knew that this was going to be sort of where this was going to go? But ultimately, I'll say, you know, we've been talking a lot about the Constitution. We've been looking, you know, you look at history. I mean, you know, yeah, the executive branches were not meant to be these powerful branches. But ultimately, the practice that has developed has been one in which the legislatures have generally sort of said, like, yeah, go do that. Go handle that because we can't.
You're better geared for this.
You're better geared
anyway.
For this. And honestly, we're incapable of working out these kinds of details anyway. We can barely pass big legislation to begin
right.
with. So the idea that we're going to hammer out even the minor details is so beyond.
But what I would say is that the scope of those areas where legislatures and the other branches are ceding authority is expanding.
Yeah.
And has expanded a lot. And I guess, again, to the theme of the podcast, and yeah. close to the end, you think this is permanent?
No. You know, and I think, you know, one of the things that we talked about earlier, the reason the administration wants the states to redistrict is because they don't want the Congress to flip, because Congress would then become a counterweight.
Yeah.
You know, it's a Republican right. Congress right now. And if it becomes a Democratic Congress, you know, then now you're running an obstacle course where you used right. to have free and clear. And so the threat of the kind of check on this is why they're fighting so hard, why the Trump administration is coming to places like Texas and saying, hey, give me 5 more seats. Hey, give me 3 more seats. Give me, you know, get me past this thing so that I can continue to run unfettered. And I think as soon as they're, you know, the fetters are there. The fetters are written into the rules. And
yeah.
eventually it comes around. And eventually you do something. I mean, you know, I do believe this about the pendulum. Eventually somebody takes it too far. You know, you go a little bit, well, he got away with that. I can go a little further than that. I can go a little further than that. And finally somebody says, wait a minute. And you know, it always comes around.
Yeah, I suspect that'll happen literally the time that the partisanship in the White House changes hands.
Well, I mean, but, I think,
you know,
well,
just,
you know,
just
I
to
mean,
say it out loud, I mean, it's not going to be that far.
If I'm a Republican and I'm in a position of power and I want Donald Trump to have all of the power he could possibly have, I think the quote this week was, I'm the president of the United States. I can do anything I want. If you want that kind of thing for your guy, then you have to be ready for their guy to have that kind of power. And, you know, I mean, you know how that goes. Everybody, you know, oh my God, we can't give that kind of stuff to you know.
Yeah, but we also know that hypocrisy means nothing.
Right.
Right. Right. We also know local control doesn't matter, right. And all these things that we've seen where it's like, yeah, that's right. True. And I mean, and again, I think, you know, and you pointed this out. I mean, I was sort of mentioning the courts. I mean, you know, the way that the shadow docket is or is not sort of more or less amenable to who's doing what with this newfound power is kind of going to be something that's going to play out over time.
Right. How can we use the tools that are available today to do the things that we want to do now?
Right.
Is how all of this stuff runs.
And how can I
impede the people I oppose from following the first line?
Well, right? And having, you know, when you have more unified parties and they're more, you know, again, broken record, but they're more homogenous. There's less of an internal check on that,
right?
In terms of just seeking, heading in one direction. I want to end, Ross, by saying, okay, so that was all sort of the national thing, where, you know, look, we could see this actually changing very quickly if the Democrats retake the House. It's the whole logic of the redistricting. I think all that is right, but the terrain is different in Texas. I mean, I think, you know, whatever happens with redistricting, we know that the House is closely divided at the national level. Pattern so far has been more alternation, et cetera, all of that. That's not the pattern here.
Right.
So does this move in a much more executive-centric direction continue here as well? Or, you know, like you were very quick to say, no, I don't think it lasts when I asked.
Right.
Does that apply to Texas too? Is my question for you.
Yeah, I think, you know, things work as long as they work. And then they, you know, and then somebody comes in and changes them. And, you know, it's usually something that is big and has public attention, that brings public attention to government in a way that it's not usually focused on government. You know, I don't know what those guys are doing in Austin. I don't care what those guys in Austin are doing. Wait a minute. I want to know what those guys in Austin are doing, right? You know, when you get a moment like that and people say, you know, something bad is going on, the people in charge need to be replaced and with something completely different. Those are those moments. You also have, you know, you also have a state full of political entrepreneurs and people who are looking at this and going, you know, I could run today. I want to run for office. I don't like the thing that they're doing with X, whatever it is. You know, I would do education differently, whatever it is. And I would do it differently, and I feel strongly about it, and I have some resources, and I can either do this within the parties or without. And if both of the parties are falling in favor and I could attract some attention, I'm going to go with that. And those kinds of people show up, you know, consistently in our history. And, you know, sometimes they're not the winners, but they change the argument. And I'm confident that that'll happen. You know, there are enough things, you know, right now Greg Abbott's doing well because there are enough things going well in the state that people are, you know, on average, okay with it. But it may be that, you know, being 43rd in education isn't good enough. And somebody comes around and says, we actually need to do something about that in a compelling way and gets people fired up about it. And all of a sudden you have a big, you know, election that's about education, or you have a big election that's about, you know, how come the state's not taking better care of us in freezes and floods, or you know, all of those kinds of things. Somebody will jump up because somebody always does. And I don't know what the issue will be. It may be that when we run the 26 elections, it's about the economy. I mean, a year from now, who knows what we're going to be talking about? It may be about, you know, we don't like the way immigration has gone in the last 12 months. But I do think that the sort of the fundamental competition in politics and the fundamental fight over where we're going has always been an engine of change, and I think it'll persist.
I guess my question to that would be, but it seems right now it's more likely to go in a more authoritative direction than a less authoritative direction.
That's where the momentum is right now. I mean, will it change? Yeah, you didn't ask me for time period.
Yeah, no, I realized that was a flaw in the question after I asked. So, well, Ross, as always, a pleasure to have you. Thank you.
Thanks for calling
Josh,
me out of the deep
retirement. Hope you had fun.
Stretch.
Thank you for joining.
Yeah.
Thanks to our excellent production crew here in the audio studio in Liberal Arts Instructional Technology Services at the University of Texas at Austin. And thanks to all of you for listening. Not a ton of data came up today, but You'll be able to find supplemental things that are supplemental to the podcast, lots of other goodies at texaspolitics.utexas.edu. So thank you all for listening. And we should be back next week, I think, with another Second Reading podcast. The Second Reading podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin.